The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Susan Dellinger from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, October 2019, Volume 20, Number 10, and this is the first of four installments this month. On this month's cover, Oprah wears a shimmery purple one-shoulder, long-sleeved, close-fitting sweater. Her left hand is raised to rest on her bare right shoulder. A huge amethyst dinner ring matches the color of the sweater. Her hair is long, full, and wavy with subtle highlights. She smiles at the camera with her smoky eyes and her soft blush kind of caramel lipstick. This month's headline is, What I Know for Sure, Healthy is the New Skinny. And now, let's look behind the scenes of this month's cover shoot. We have a black and white photograph here of Oprah sitting in front of the makeup mirror in a white robe, and she is having her hair worked on. Oprah says, makeup lets you experiment and be whoever you want to be in that moment. There's an inset down below with her hair having been perfectly made up, and her lips are being worked on. The top picture, Oprah is tickled as Mangrum adds some texture to her hair. And then we have a hand that has lots of lipsticks painted on it in different shades. So Routledge does a hands-on tone test before applying the lipstick. And then we have the picture of Oprah having her perfect pout applied. The heading for this page is Face to Face. When Lizzo's anthem juice filled the dressing room, the opening line, Mirror, Mirror on the Wall, was right on cue. There sat Oprah in robe and slippers, occasionally checking her reflection as her trusted glam squad, makeup artist Derek Routledge and hairstylist Nicole Mangrum, expertly did their thing. Oprah said with a laugh, at this point, they could get me ready, blindfolded. Meanwhile, photographer Reuven Effendor was liking the way the glow of the mirror lights framed his subject, and when it came to time to shoot, the set was ready with an illuminated vanity that similarly showed off Oprah's dazzling look. We ask you, what better way to kick off our Fall Beauty Awards than with a cover close-up of such total gorgeousness? And to get this look, we have some lipsticks here. Maybelline New York Superstay Ink Crayon. And here are the colors. Lead the Way, Seek Adventure, Laugh Louder, Own Your Empire, and Settle for More. They're $9.50 at drugstores. Now let me tell you how that translates. The first one is a deep red. The next one's a deep pink. Next is a really bright coral. And then a bright red, and then kind of a claret color. Below that, Maybelline New York Tattoo Studio Liquid Ink Liner, $8 at Studios. Every makeup session requires the same thing, says the subtitle, the creative coordination of color. For this look, Routledge used a nude shade on Oprah's lips and a combo of earthy shadows on her lids with a swipe of liquid liner on her lash lines and a couple of coats of mascara. Now, here we go from Oprah. For 2 years, I didn't sleep well. Never a full night, no peace. Restlessness and heart palpitations were my steady companions at nightfall. This was back when I was 48 to 50. I went to see a cardiologist, took medication, wore a heart monitor for weeks, and then one day, walking through the offices of the Oprah Winfrey Show, I picked up a copy of The Wisdom of Menopause, Dr. Christiane Northrup's book, and the pages fell open to the heading, Palpitations, Your Heart's Wake-Up Call. I took it as a sign. Contained in that book was the answer I'd been going doctor to doctor trying to find out. Heart palpitations and sleeplessness were indications that the change was coming. But no one, including my trusted doctors, had warned me. And when my symptoms showed up, we looked for the most dire explanation, heart disease, instead of the most likely. I did multiple shows about my discovery because at the time, almost no one was talking about menopause. Until that point in my adult life, I don't recall one serious conversation with another woman about what to expect. Sure, I'd heard about hot flashes, but I wasn't prepared for palpitations. And after my menstrual cycle stopped for good at 53, I wasn't prepared to have such difficulty concentrating. Reading, my favorite pastime, became a chore. Suddenly, my attitude towards most things was whatever. I wasn't vibrant. My whole world dulled down a couple of notches. Then a friend mentioned that she felt the same dullness and that her doctor had recommended an estrogen supplement. Bingo! For me, too, that proved to be the answer. Mine comes in cream form. I just rub it on my arm. All it took was one application, and the world returned to Technicolor. I could feel my countenance shifting. For the first time in years, I was sleeping the whole night through. I did a show about my miracle treatment, wrote about it in O, told everybody I could, including Gail, of course, who opted not to try it because the type of supplement I use, yes, I still use it, is controversial. But for me, the quality of life it's brought has been worth it. Once again, I love going places and doing things, especially reading. Speaking of reading, we have a lot of it for you in this issue. Not just our deep dive into all things menopause, but also one woman's remarkable story of betrayal and forgiveness. Our guide to looking and feeling more like yourself during breast cancer treatment, and a fascinating glimpse into the creative process behind one of the most powerful books I've read in years, that incredible debut novel by Ta-Nehisi Coates. I hope you take something from every one of this month's stories, and I hope you thrive. Oprah. And we have a page that is really bright and colorful, and right in the middle, there's a diamond that says your take on topics we're covering this month. And in the upper left-hand corner, we have a scattering of beauty products. Now, none of these are labeled. They're all, you know, just silver cylinders of lipstick and tubes that are solid colors. The question is, how many beauty products do you use daily? 12% of us said enough to fill a drugstore aisle. 88% said just a handful. I'm easy breezy. And next we have a picture of a couple in bed, backs to each other, looking off in opposite directions. How do you move past a big fight is the question. 33% say, I like to talk it out right then and there. 67% say, I need my space first. And of course, these are stories in this month's issue. Now, the next picture is an egg with a big white egg with a big black Q on it. How do you like your eggs? 35% said in a perfectly cooked omelet. 65% said scrambled, fluffy, and fabulous. Now we have a picture of a woman hiking with fall leaves around her, and she's in the mountains, and there's a nice mist over the distant mountains. Which would you rather do on a fall weekend? 26% said ride my bike, and 74% said take a hike. And finally, with an open book and a glass of wine, we have the question, do you belong to a book club? 84% said no, but I'd like to. 16% said, of course, it's my favorite night of the month. We'll head to the reading room, and instead of the usual 10 titles to pick up now, we have the fall 15. There is much to love about autumn, not least that it's the season when readers get to curl up with some of the biggest, most anticipated books of the year. We gathered this bounty of must-reads, an Oktoberfest to savor. Number one on the list, The Testaments by Margaret Atwood. The grand dame of dystopian fiction revisits the way too close for comfort totalitarian world of Gilead in this magnificent sequel to The Handmaid's Tale. Filled with her signature pitch black humor and blistering critiques of patriarchy gone wild, Atwood's follow-up expands the universe of the original in spine-tingling ways. For starters, by revealing the backstory of the villainous Aunt Lydia. The second title, Heaven My Home, by Attica Locke. When a 9-year-old goes missing on a vast lake, who do you call? In this scalp-prickling encore to her Edgar-winning Bluebird, Bluebird, Locke brings back intrepid Texas Ranger Darren Matthews, who tracks the boy's trail to the town of Jefferson, a gumbo of race and class prejudices captured in vivid detail. Quote, a Miller High Life, a pre-made bologna sandwich, bluesy Zydeco on the radio, end of quote. The third title, Whose Story Is This?, by Rebecca Solnit. In 20 essential essays, the firebrand feminist thinker probes such zeitgeisty topics as whether, quote, the fall of men has been greatly exaggerated, end of quote, and male anger is, quote, a public safety issue, end of quote. Ultimately, Solnit concludes we are, quote, moving on to a future with more people and more voices and more possibilities, end of quote. The fourth title, The Secrets We Kept, by Laura Prescott. This cinematic Cold War thriller spins a seductive spy drama from the covert mission to publish Boris Pasternak's classic Russian romance, Dr. Zhivago, as a strategy to undermine the Soviets, a real-life plot unveiled several years ago in the Washington Post. Among the cast of this fictional rendering are Pasternak's muse and mistress and the tight-lipped ladies of the CIA's secretarial pool who see and hear all. The fifth title is Girl by Edna O'Brien. The lauded Irish novelist leaps continents in a feat of imagination that transmogrifies headlines into a searing fable of violence and resilience. Miriam, a Nigerian girl abducted by Boko Haram, survives repeated rapes and betrayals through sheer will. In spare, exacting prose, O'Brien aims her saga like a divining rod at, quote, the best of all knowing and feeling and forgiving, end of quote. The sixth title, The World That We Knew, by Alice Hoffman. Berlin, 1941. The summit of Nazi power and brutality. A mother must spirit her child away from certain death with the aid of a rabbi's daughter and a female golem. Together they raise a torch against history's darkest night. In Hoffman's telling, evil mingles with courage and the, quote, cruel perversions of men, end of quote, are poised against sanctuaries where, quote, angels walked through the yellow grass, end of quote. The seventh title, The Grammarians, by Kathleen Shine. Brandeishing wild-esque whimsy, the author of The Three Wisemans of Westport returns with an effervescent story of identical twin word nerds. One's a copy editor with a column called The People's Pedant, the other a kindergarten teacher whose increasingly divergent means of self-expression threaten their ludicrously close sisterhood. The eighth title is Face It by Debbie Harry. The trailblazing frontwoman shares tales of growing up in New Jersey amid hobos and raccoons, creating a girl drag persona that was an homage to Marilyn Monroe, surviving New York City's bad old days, posing for Andy Warhol, and touring the world with Blondie. The big reveal, beneath the bleach and ballsiness is a heart of glass, shattered by the anguish of being abandoned by her birth mother. The ninth title, Dominicana, by Angie Cruz. 15-year-old Anna acquiesces to her mother's wishes and marries 32-year-old smooth talker Juan, who whisks her away from a rural Dominican village to the Big Apple. Yet her new husband and country aren't all she imagined, as the former turns abusive and the latter erupts with the tumult of the 60s. The heroine of this wondrous fish-out-of-water story tries to hold steady, knowing, quote, a well-placed rock in a river changes the current, end of quote. The 10th title, Out of Darkness, Shining Light, by Patina Grappa. When the explorer David Livingstone dies, his African entourage vows to bear his body to the coast for eventual burial in England. Based on Livingstone's journals and narrated by his gossipy cook and a freed man with a messiah complex, this textured novel illuminates the agonies of colonialism and blind loyalty. Conrad's Heart of Darkness in Reverse. The 11th title, Sontag, by Benjamin Moser. A towering figure like Susan Sontag deserves a towering tome, and Moser's 700-plus page biography of the iconic cultural critic delivers. Following its subject from forsaken daughter of an alcoholic single mother to intellectual guru setting the worlds of art and letters ablaze, this blockbuster a la Stacey Schiff's Cleopatra is both granular and grand, an opus fit for the writer-philosopher who, quote, created the mold and then she broke it, end of quote. The 12th title, Make It Scream, Make It Burn, by Leslie Jamison. A whale's song pulses unanswered through the briny deep. A toddler recalls a past life as a World War II pilot. A photographer becomes obsessed with a destitute Mexican family. In these enthralling essays, the empathy exams author travels the landscape of hope and sorrow, mixing reportage and criticism while drawing on her own vulnerability. The 13th title, Encantoras, by Carolina de Robertis. Tired of swimming against the tide of the oppressive Uruguayan dictatorship of the 1970s, five gay women flee to the country's idyllic coastline in search of solace and solidarity. Over the next three decades, they form a, quote, family stitched together by the very fact that they'd been torn from the fabric of the accepted world, end of quote. Every line of this gorgeous and grippingly adventurous tale sings with lush, aqueous beauty. The 14th title, The Second Founding, by Eric Foner. Not all constitutional amendments are created equal. A Pulitzer Prize-winning historian pares away the myths surrounding the 13th, 14th, and 15th, which abolished slavery, guaranteed all citizens due process under the law, and vastly expanded voting rights, while tracing their DNA through today's body politic. Foner's peerless scholarship and radiant humanity uncover the battles royal that tested the nation's character and royal us still. And the 15th and final title is Akin, by Emma Donahue. The author of the literary phenomenon Room returns with a soul-stirring novel in which octogenarian Noah, a childless Manhattan widower, is forced to become guardian to 11-year-old Michael, a grandnephew he's never met. The unlikely pair, Noah, world-weary and tech-challenged, Michael, street smart and in need of a father figure, bond over a family mystery whose clues lead them to France. There they piece together the half-century-old puzzle of whether Noah's mother was a member of the resistance or a Nazi sympathizer. Still in the reading room, we have Behind the Book, a column called Origin Story. And I want to apologize for probably not getting this author's name correct. Ta-Nehisi Coates. His remarkable debut novel, The Water Dancer, is the odyssey of an enslaved man's journey out of bondage, aided by a superpower he didn't know he had, the impulse to create this character and to interweave history, fantasy, and symbolism goes all the way back to the author's childhood, he reveals to O Books editor Lee Haber. A recipient of the National Book Award and MacArthur Genius Grant, Ta-Nehisi Coates, 44, has explored the importance of archetypes, especially as they relate to the African-American story, in his previous books, The Beautiful Struggle, Between the World and Me, and We Were 8 Years in Power. But he's been thinking about how myths mold our perspective pretty much his whole life. At 5, he says, quote, "I was in the back seat of my parents' red station wagon, talking about my favorite television show, The Tarzan, Lone Ranger, Zorro, Adventure Hour, and I told my dad how much I loved Tarzan," end of quote. His father, Paul, dubbed Conscious Man by his son in The Beautiful Struggle, was skeptical. As a member of the Black Panther Party and devotee of obscure works about African and African-American history, Paul never missed a chance to school his son about his heritage. In this case, he wanted Ta-Nehisi to understand the subtext of the Tarzan legend and to know that his dad objected to this white man in, quote, the jungles of Africa, acting like a hero among savages, end of quote. The dad told the son he wouldn't be allowed to watch Tarzan until he could see for himself the racist undertones, that there was more to it than the adventures of a guy in a loincloth swinging from vine to vine. In fact, his son would be barred from watching any TV for a week while he worked out why the story shouldn't be taken at face value. What could possibly be wrong with Tarzan? Coates recalls thinking. Over the next few days, he and his father debated. Paul shared books and images for context and expounded on why only certain types of people are portrayed as heroes in our history and literature. What Coates now calls the knowledge started to sink in. He kept watching Tarzan, but returned again and again to his father's words. He says, quote, "Those were my first deep lessons," end of quote. Coates was an early reader. His mom was a school teacher who instructed him herself. By the time he got to first grade, he remembers, quote, "wondering why everyone read so slow," end of quote. At home in his bedroom, he pored over a set of Childcraft encyclopedias and spent hours at the Enoch Pratt Free Library, winning a prize for getting through the most books in the summer. He says, quote, "School was something I did to keep people off my back. Learning was something I did on my own," end of quote. Coates' parents allowed him to have action figures only with black skin. For instance, Roadblock and Stalker, the black soldiers who back up G.I. Joe. He also loved comic books. Superheroes' exploits transported him out of West Baltimore, where kids worried about getting beaten up or shot. He writes in The Beautiful Struggle, quote, "I knew that to be afraid while on the way to school was deeply wrong," end of quote. Though there were a few black characters in the Marvel Universe, apart from Black Panther, Falcon, and Luke Cage, Coates detected in the X-Men, and particularly Spider-Man, an underdog quality he identified with. He says, quote, "I never thought of Peter Parker as white. If anything, I related him to black people because he was poor and always trying to do the right thing, though most of the time there was no reward waiting for him at the end. It wasn't about skin color. It was about where you existed in society," end of quote. Comics stretched his vocabulary. Coates says, quote, "They're big and boisterous and use a kind of high language you don't come across every day," end of quote. Hip-hop and rap also shaped him, he goes on to say, quote, "It was the first place I really remember being struck by the fact that you could organize words rhythmically and create beautiful feelings. I wanted to do that. I guess that tied into some ancestral ideas about drumming and oral history," end of quote. But it was in the work of W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, and on the pages of the black classic press books his father brought back to print, that Coates found his most solid footing. As he puts it, quote, "I was anchored," end of quote. After attending Howard University, he spent years as a freelance journalist and later as a staff writer for the Village Voice, then the Atlantic. He became an outspoken critic of a society in which the, quote, falsehood of race, end of quote, burdens black men and women. In 2009, he went on what he calls a Civil War bender, devouring everything he could find on the topic. He considers the project ongoing. He'd heard people argue that the conflict wasn't really about slavery, that Robert E. Lee represented a grand, gallant Confederacy with the Old South a romantic lost cause. But after a close reading of the Ordinances of Secession and other documents, he knew there was no gray area. If people chose to believe the war hadn't been about keeping or freeing slaves, quote, it was because they didn't want to let the facts violate myth. They didn't want to let go of heroes who'd organized the way they saw things, end of quote. Coates remained a fan of superheroes and their adventures, and in 2016, his revival of the Black Panther character for a new graphic comic series was published. In 2018, Ryan Coogler's T'Challa-centric movie Black Panther premiered to frenzied acclaim. In the fictional land of Wakanda, African Americans saw relatable myths and superheroes on a grand scale. Coates says, quote, Black Panther was a revelation for black people around the world. It made us more aware of the role heroes play and who deserves to be seen as admirable. White heroes have been given that kind of big budget treatment for decades, end of quote. In his astonishing new work, the novel The Water Dancer, Hiram Walker is a hero in his own right, born into bondage and without memory of his mother until he finds a hidden power enabling him to connect with the past. The experience lifts him out of near catatonic despair and into an awakened state where, quote, even in the darkness, some part of me smiled, end of quote. Hiram learns to draw strength from those who came before. He even joins forces with Harriet Tubman, aka Moses, whose soul was, quote, scarred but not broken by the worst of slavery. Hiram grew stronger, grew faster, and this began not with the body, but with the mind, end of quote. Coates' beautiful struggle to reconcile the present with the past, youthful idealism with hard-won realism, fact with myth, has given us an electric retelling of an old story. This modern masterpiece enables us to comprehend what it must be to have never known freedom and risk everything to attain it. And now we move to the special feature section of the magazine. And this is the part where every month I love to see what the creative folks at O have come up with to give us the Oprah O. And this month, for the fall, we're looking down at a campfire that's been built on just some rocky soil in the woods. We see some pine boughs and some pine cones scattered around. And the campfire is surrounded by big rocks. And these big rocks form the Oprah O. So we've got skinny rocks at the top and then doubled up big rocks on the sides to give us that O that's almost in a circle on the outside and an oval on the inside. And there are logs that are burning, and then there are three or four sticks hovering over the fire, and they've got marshmallows on them. October 2019. Holding a grudge may bring temporary satisfaction, but truly delicious things happen when you can assess your sweet, gooey center and find a way to forgive. And this article is called A Family Affair. Emily Bernard spent much of her adult life resenting her father's mistress, going so far as to plot revenge. Then after decades of bitterness, she realized it was time to do what she never dreamed she could, forgive. I don't understand why he would buy it for her. My mother sat at the kitchen table while my brothers and I orbited her chair. She kept track of our family finances, had come across a curious receipt. My father had purchased a plane ticket for one of his patients, Jeanette Curie. My mother said, quote, it doesn't make any sense, end of quote, as much to herself as to us. I teased. You worry too much, Mom. My mother was a fretful person, supervisor of details and predictor of all that could go wrong. I just wanted to change the subject. It was December 1988 at my parents' home in Nashville. I was on winter break from college, and my older brother, James, was back from New York to spend Christmas with us. My younger brother, Warren, was a high school senior. As siblings, we had our differences, but we always snapped together like magnets around our mother, whom we uniformly adored. I wanted her to relax and join our reunion, cracking inside jokes the four of us had honed over many years. I was sure my father would eventually explain the ticket. What I didn't know then was that for several years he had been building a secret life with Jeanette Curie at its center. My father was an OBGYN. He met Jeanette when she was a 24-year-old intern in his practice. She was married and training to become a medical assistant. After she left the position, my father, 30 years older than Jeanette, became her doctor. My mother, who managed the office, was taken by the younger woman's kooky wit. My mother said of her, quote, "She's quite a character," end of quote. Jeanette was what we Southerners describe as colorful, and my mother loved a character. She didn't have a clue about the role this one would play in our lives. In 1988, my mother was 50 years old, 2 years younger than I am now. She had settled into middle age, her long hair streaked with gray and coiled in a bun. She wore smart, unfussy clothing and little makeup, but I prefer to think of her as she was in a photograph from her time at Fisk University. Her wavy hair cascades over her shoulders. Her eyes are large and dark, her lips full and red, with a Marilyn Monroe mole just above. She emanates youthful promise. She'd been a brilliant poetry student, mentored by the preeminent African-American poet Robert Hayden. She was accomplished in the sciences, more talented than my father, even, I've been told. They met at the local church. My mother was passionate about the arts in the early days. They went to movies and museums and poetry readings together. They also shared a commitment to thrift, modesty, and becoming denizens of Nashville's black upper middle class. When they married, though, my mother tabled any career aspirations in favor of being the perfect doctor's wife. My father had soft, curly hair and strong white teeth. I looked just like him, down to the faintness of his eyebrows and the planes of his face. My smile is his. He was perpetually trim and deeply charismatic, and always knew just what he wanted. He inspired with his charm and controlled with his silence, but he was often absent, and that made my parents' marriage difficult. Over the years, my mother grew depressed, and a few months after that Christmas break, Jeanette's phone calls began. Quote, "Jeanette Curie won't stop calling Mom," end of quote, I wrote in a 1989 journal in my dorm room at Yale. Quote, "Why is she doing this to her?" End of quote. In the space of a few months, Jeanette had become like a burglar in our home, invading our mother's peace of mind, robbing us of our sense of well-being, phoning at all hours, asking to speak to my father. She claimed that her son Lee was my father's, which he denied, telling my mother Jeanette was crazy. My mother believed him, so we did too, but Jeanette was relentless. She brought Lee to my father's office when my mother wasn't there, explaining that, quote, "The baby needs to see his father," end of quote. He said Jeanette was just out to get his money. When I came home between semesters, I felt Jeanette's unsettling presence even more. The telephone jangled continuously, jabbing the air like a witch's crooked finger. That's how I'd come to think of Jeanette Curie, like a witch who wanted to do evil to our family. My mother changed our phone number several times, but Jeanette always managed to get the new one. One night, instead of hanging up on her, my mother asked Jeanette, "What do you want from me?" Jeanette responded, "I want to be the doctor's wife. I want to live in the house on the hill." My mother and I laughed darkly at this. "You have to hand it to Jeanette," she told me. "She won't be ignored." A picture from when I was little shows my arms wrapped possessively around my father's neck. Family and friends of his generation remember how close we once were. That ended when I hit puberty, and suddenly I was gripped by emotions I could neither understand nor control. I spent my adolescence fearing my father. It wasn't violence I was afraid of. It was his judgment. I felt his assessing eyes on me constantly. "I hate you," I screamed at him when I was 12. He slapped me solidly across the face. He said evenly, "You are rotten to the core." He didn't speak to me for weeks until my mother insisted I apologize. This routine, an argument, his silence, my compelled "I'm sorry," defined the contours of our relationship. While my mother sympathized with me, he was my father, and so she believed I should defer to him. None of us, including my mother, was permitted to question him. Not once did I ever believe Jeanette Curry was being truthful about my father or her son. It didn't occur to me to doubt my father's word. Jeanette wasn't even a member of our community. My parents socialized exclusively with people like themselves, well-educated black professional men and their wives. But Jeanette's the youngest of 10 kids. Her mother had her first child at 15. Her father died of tuberculosis when she was 1. Jeanette and her family sometimes resorted to welfare to get by, while my father tooled around in his beloved blue Mercedes. He cared about appearances, and the Currys, who lived in East Nashville and moved 8 times in 6 years, seemed like exactly the kind of people my father hadn't wanted us to become. But a few months after the calls began, a paternity test triggered by Child Protective Services put the lie to it all. Lee was my father's son, yet my father continued to deny the truth, offering rationales about the fallibility of such tests, which my mother clung to. Then she found a letter in my father's bedside cabinet from his attorney, urging him to stop lying to his wife because it would just make the situation worse. When my mother confronted my father, he waved off his indiscretion as something men were entitled to and suggested we all move on. Even I felt the sting of humiliation and betrayal. My mother, ever a tender and forgiving soul, crumpled. Despite the evidence, she hadn't seen this coming. Afterward, I barely spoke to my father, but the person I blamed was Jeanette. I fantasized about hiring someone to scare her or break her kneecaps. My mother was deeply religious, and our Episcopal church was her solace. She and my father had been married there. My brothers and I were baptized there and later served as acolytes in the chapel. One day in 1989, during a visit home, we were seated in our usual pew at St. Anselm's when there was a stir behind us. It was the Currys walking to a pew not 10 feet from ours. St. Anselm's was a small parish, and rumors had swirled about my father's other son. I felt the gaze of all the churchgoers around us as my dignified mother trained her attention on the Book of Common Prayer, reciting the lines she knew by heart. I suppressed my desire to rip the prayer book from Jeanette Curry's undeserving hands. It would only have embarrassed my mother further. I wanted to cover her body with mine to shield her from the titillation and scorn, but instead I seethed. Soon thereafter, my mother stopped going to St. Anselm's. Then so did I. Another reason to hate Jeanette Curry. Despite everything, my parents stayed together. It took a toll on my mother. When she'd first discovered the affair, she made attempts to get into shape, to do her hair differently, to apply lipstick before my father got home. But now I could see how weary she was. Over the next 2 decades, she developed chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which severely compromised her breathing. By the end of her life, she rarely left the house. During our last conversation, when she was 70, she sat in an easy chair in the den as I caught her up on news about my husband and 2 daughters. My father came home and asked whether she needed anything, resting a gentle hand on her shoulder. 3 weeks later, she died. My grief was excruciating, made all the harder when I thought of the beautiful college girl with infinite opportunities she'd given up and what she'd settled for. I knew it was a broken heart that had finally killed her. My father and I had grown distant, but just 8 weeks before my mother's death, she urged me, "Don't leave your father out." Still, 8 years later, we remained extremely uncomfortable with each other. But lately, he'd taken an interest in my writing after Reverend Cynthia, St. Anselm's young priest, shared an essay of mine she'd found in an online publication. I was finishing up a book about my family, Black as the Body, and on a whim decided to fly from Vermont, where I was a university professor, to Nashville to reconnect with my father and ask him some questions about our past. Our conversation was awkward, but we both made an effort. I asked what it was like to live in the house where my mother had died nearly a decade before. Not only had he not moved, but he'd even kept my mother's pill bottles on the bathroom sink where they'd always been. I'd brought him to the sink to ask why. He said, "I guess I'm still in love with your mother." We stood together, hugging tightly. The next morning, I called my daughters before they left for school. As we chatted, I heard my father moving around slowly downstairs. Then nothing. I hung up the phone, got dressed, and opened the door to the den. My father was slumped in the easy chair, the one my mother had always favored. His hands were clasped over his stomach, and his eyes were closed. "Dad," I whispered. Then I noticed a narrow stream of vomit on the lapel of his ancient maroon bathrobe. "Dad," I screamed and called 911. The paramedics confirmed that he died of a massive heart attack. Another broken heart? I sobbed into the phone with my husband and brothers. Then I searched for the photo of the two of us when I was 5, when we were entwined. The next day, I made funeral arrangements. I didn't know much about the last years of my father's life. I didn't even have the name of his primary care physician. So I called Reverend Cynthia, with whom I knew he'd grown close. She told me what she could. Then she suggested I reach out to Jeanette Curry, who would know more. The sound of her name enraged me. "How dare you say that to me?" I fumed. I was about to hang up when Reverend Cynthia softly asked, "Would it be okay if I came over?" Soon she was sitting across from me in my parents' living room, sharing revelation upon revelation about the depth of my father's relationship with Jeanette. Since my mother's death, my father had eaten dinner at the Curry's house every night, including the night before he died, she told me. Jeanette's grandchildren called him Grandpa. He helped them with their homework, played with them after school, drove them to church on Sundays. Lee was then in prison on a drug charge, but was going to be paroled to my father upon his release. The details rocked me to my core. The reality was this. My father loved the Currys and had spent more time with them in the latter part of his life than with me or my brothers. How could he have done this to us? How could he care so much for a woman who tormented my mother? I said. But I could tell that Reverend Cynthia didn't see Jeanette the way I did. "I wish you could have known my mother," I said through tears. "I've heard so many beautiful stories about her," Reverend Cynthia said. I returned to my life in Vermont and tried to wipe Jeanette Curry from my mind, but I kept wondering. About a year and a half after my father died, I wrote to Reverend Cynthia and asked if she would set up a meeting for me with Jeanette Curry. She has many questions that are left unanswered and is hoping you can help her understand her dad better, is how she explained it to Jeanette. I didn't fully know what I hoped to accomplish in our face-to-face, which was set to take place at the church, though there were two lines I'd rehearsed years earlier in case circumstances ever again brought us into contact. "You hurt my mother. That's all I need to know about you." I wanted to look into Jeanette's eyes and shout these words just to make sure she understood. As I entered the church, I steeled myself. My body held as much fear as it did anger. Then I took a seat. Before me sat a slight woman with dark brown eyes, not unlike mine, though her eyebrows were plucked into thin arches. She had deep brown skin and a broad, sculpted nose. She wore a modest gray cap on her head. There was nothing menacing about her. In fact, her smile was impish. I was not charmed. I had questions. Why did you have to start coming to our church, humiliating us, especially my mother? I knew that while ours was an Anglican Episcopal church, Jeanette preferred the Pentecostal tradition, where she could shout and praise Jesus. Bernard told me to come. She always called my father by his last name or by Doc. But why would he do that? I wanted to know. She told me he thought that eventually her presence would seem normal and he can enjoy life the way he wanted to, being surrounded at all times by people devoted to him. He promised Jeanette that if she did as he asked, including having her husband adopt Lee, he would incorporate Lee into his life. He also promised her me. I would mentor one of her grandchildren, he told her, if she lived according to his rules. I quietly informed Jeanette that my father had never mentioned the name of her grandchild to me, much less the promise he'd made. She lowered her eyes, and I realized suddenly that my father had manipulated her as much as he had us. I remembered a scene from years before, one of the few times I brought my children to church in Nashville. Jeanette had approached me and my then 8-year-old daughter, Isabella, at the passing of the peace. "She's gotten so big," she exclaimed, looking into my eyes as if to share a moment of mutual motherhood. Isabella leaned in for a hug, moved by the warmth and intimacy of Jeanette's words. Instinctively, I put my hand on Isabella's back. I didn't want the hands of this lying woman on my child's body. It dawned on me now, sitting with Jeanette, that my father had encouraged her to think of herself as part of his family, while allowing us to assume she'd invited herself in. I asked how she'd known what my daughter looked like. My father had shown her photos, Jeanette said. We had been talking for an hour. I was confused and tired and needed to collect my thoughts. I started to gather my things when Jeanette blurted, "I just wanted your mother to forgive me. I wanted her forgiveness so bad." I sat back down. The truth of her words pierced the membrane between us. She told me her guilt had inspired her to become a preacher. I felt my shoulders loosen, my jaw unclench, and something inside me began to open. I could see that Jeanette was truly sorry. She was sorry with her whole being. Like my mother, like Jeanette, I believed in God and redemption. If it's a consolation, I told Jeanette, my mother was talking about forgiveness a lot at the end of her life. There's no reason to think that didn't include you. I was careful with my words. Absolution wasn't mine to give, but Jeanette's relief was visible. We talked for another 2 hours. Jeanette said her sexual relationship with my father had ended as quickly as it began, that she had wanted not my father's money, but for him to take an interest in Lee and eventually encourage my brothers and me to develop a relationship with him. As for the harassing phone calls, Jeanette admitted she hadn't behaved well toward my mother, but her forced secrecy made her desperate to be acknowledged. Desperate for legitimacy, and ultimately desperate for my mother's forgiveness, even if she had to bully it out of her. This I now know. If Jeanette was a little crazy in those days, it was in no small measure my father's fault. After my mother died, she explained, all the Currys, Jeanette, Lee, her husband, their grandchildren, became my father's family. When Lee went to prison, they worried together and relied on one another. At their house every night, my father settled on the couch to watch sports and the news, insisting that Jeanette's husband Larry sit next to him.
Several times he asked Larry to drive him to visit his investment property in another part of Tennessee. He trusted Larry and always fell asleep at the beginning of the long drive. "Can you believe that?" Jeanette asked me, even though he could have cut his throat. "I can't say I would have blamed him," I said. We laughed, then we hugged, and I got up to leave. "Isn't it nuts that we're communicating like this?" I texted Jeanette recently. She responded, "We are learning to trust each other." It's been 2 years since our first meeting, and Jeanette and I are getting to know each other. We are on a shared mission to understand and make peace with the past. When I see her or hear from her, I search inside for that old rage that used to saturate my every cell, but it's gone. Anger never got me any closer to understanding my father or his choices, but through Jeanette, I think I see him more clearly. She sends me Bible passages and memories of my dad. Once she asked me to help her granddaughter with a writing assignment. I agreed without hesitation. Sometimes Jeanette includes love in her text messages to me. Sometimes I sent a heart emoji in return. And on a sidebar, we have mercy for author and conservationist Terry Tempest Williams. Forgiveness is a strength. I think of forgiveness as different sets of triptychs that keep presenting themselves. We are hurt by someone or something, transgression. We are changed by that trauma, either paralyzed in our pain or spurred to face and move beyond it, transition. If we are successful in processing it, we succeed in rising above, stronger, transformation. When I was in Rwanda, I saw extraordinary examples of forgiveness. A woman whose husband and son were murdered found out who the perpetrator was and went to that young man. She said, "I know you killed my son. You killed my husband. You are now my son. We will live with that together and heal." What I saw in Rwanda is that you can forgive without forgetting. Forgiveness is fierce. At this moment in time, it's essential. When we feel powerless, it's forgiveness that enables us to reclaim our power, to begin to melt our hardened souls. And on another page in this article, there's another sidebar. Can we forgive ourselves? Edith Eva Eger, an Auschwitz survivor, shows us the way. Dr. Mengele lifted his finger. "Is she your mother or your sister?" he asks. I say, "Mother." As soon as the word is out of my mouth, I want to pull it back into my throat. "Sister, sister, sister," I want to scream. Mengele points my mother to the left. She follows behind the young children and the elderly, the mothers who are pregnant or are holding babies in their arms. Could I have saved my mother? Maybe. And I will live for the rest of my life with that possibility. And I can castigate myself for having made the wrong choice. That is my prerogative. Or I can accept that the more important choice is not the one I made when I was hungry and terrified, when we were surrounded by dogs and guns and uncertainty when I was 16. It's the one I make now, the choice to accept myself as I am, human and imperfect. And then there's one last sidebar for this article, A Love Supreme. U.S. Poet Laureate Joy Harjo muses on our infinite ability to care. This heart can hold a country, a mountain range, or an island of white birds. As the sun comes up and the sun goes down, there are songs of brokenness and songs of putting back together. In this heart will be storm and flood or rain of fire. There is walking away and coming together. There are rooms of emptiness that need no breath. There are no rooms at all, only fields of flowers. There is always room for children to play. In this heart are oceans with sailing boats to take you home. As for enemies, let them go their own way. This heart has doorways for leaving, for what needs to be left behind. There is always a room for anyone who's gone astray. The heart makes a song of all this. There it is beneath your ribs. It will sing you how to live.
it will tell you to forgive. As we wrap up this first installment, let's look at some items from the pet edition of the O list. And on the first page, kind of trickling down in space against a white background, like they're fluttering, are 6 plates, dinner plates, and they're white with little formal gold kind of scrolls and curlicues on the rims, and painted flowers, and almost a primitive style of painting used for, we have some dog heads and some kitty cat heads, and the title is Hot Plates. These charming stoneware dishes look every bit as whimsical and quirky on a kitchen wall as they do on a kitchen table. Jennifer Orkin Lewis for 180 Degrees Ring Around the Petsy Plates. Originally $60 for a set of 4, now 20% off with code OPRA, 180.shop. And then we have some dog jackets being modeled by some labradoodles. One looks a bit like a denim jacket, and the other is a leopard print. Mommy and Me is the heading. Keep your BFF on trend with a trucker jacket that features a harness hole. Bonus, it also comes in human sizes, happily without the harness hole. Dog jackets from $55 each, now 20% off with code OPRA at dl1961.com. And now we have a medicine bottle with a dropper, Creature Comfort. Is your pup worried about the election? The Dope Dog Dropper provides organic hemp-derived CBD, THC-free and human-grade. It's mellow the harsh of anxiety, aggression, epilepsy, arthritis, and skin and GI tract issues. Dope Dog Dropper 500, originally $80, now 20% off with code OPRA at dope.dog. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Susan Dellinger, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.